This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When the internet started to really catch on in the 90s, it was widely seen as a form of communication that transcended geographical boundaries, a force for freedom that could not be controlled by governments. But as countries like China have demonstrated, governments are figuring out how to censor information on the net. According to the new book, Who Controls the Internet, the net is splitting apart and becoming bordered. Governments are imposing national laws on the net within their borders. Who Controls the Internet explores the consequences and virtues of an internet regulated by national laws. My guests are the authors, Jack Goldsmith and Tim Wu. Goldsmith is a law professor at Harvard and headed the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel in 2003 and 2004. Wu is a law professor at Columbia, writes for the online magazine Slate, and previously worked in the internet telecommunications industry. Well, let's look at a case that you consider to be a turning point in government control of the internet. And this was a few years ago when Yahoo was selling Nazi materials on an auction site. And that's illegal in France. France wanted those pages blocked there. What was the case that the French government made?
The auction page was actually on a computer in California, but the French government argued that its availability in France violated French law just the same way as if the goods were actually there or if they appeared in a magazine that was actually there. It argued that when Yahoo was doing business in France, it had to comply with French law just like anyone doing business in France would have to.
And what was the law that the French government said Yahoo was breaking?
They have a law, against, simply a law against the offering of sale of Nazi goods, no matter what the medium.
And this is related to laws against hate speech and hate crimes? And
sure. It grows out of France's experience in World War II with the Holocaust and with the German occupation and the like. And Europe is much more sensitive to hate speech and to Nazi speech than we are in the United States. They have a different conception of free speech, and they regulate these activities much more heavily than the United States does.
Okay, so you described France's case. What was Yahoo's case?
Well, Yahoo argued that it was inappropriate or unfair for France to tell Yahoo what to do in the United States, because remember, the web page was actually located on a computer in the United States. And Yahoo argued that it couldn't stop the goods, the web page, from going into France, and that if it was forced to shut down its website in California, that in effect France would be regulating these Nazi goods for the whole world because Yahoo would have to shut them down to everyone.
And didn't Yahoo also argue that it would be virtually impossible to honor the laws of many different countries while running its websites?
Yes, they argued, first of all, that they couldn't keep the web page out of France and they couldn't comply with 190 different national laws all around the world because, they argued, the internet is not bordered. We can't keep information from going into different countries. And therefore, the only choice Yahoo had was to allow the web page to be seen everywhere or to shut it down and allow it to be seen nowhere.
So what was the outcome?
The French judge didn't accept that argument. He hired some internet experts who argued, and remember this was 5 or 6 years ago, he argued that the experts argued that Yahoo could in fact screen out information to a reasonable degree. In fact, Yahoo was filtering geographically in its advertising side. So whenever you typed in yahoo.com in France, you would actually receive a French advertisement rather than an English advertisement. The judge argued that Yahoo could filter out to some degree, and he ordered it to take all reasonable steps to keep the web pages out of France. Yahoo eventually complied.
So what precedent did this set internationally?
Well, you know, I think what was so interesting about the case is that it pitted these ideals of the internet, of freedom, of being borderless, of being uncontrollable, and being a medium that anyone could do anything with, against a very set of hard facts that Europe has had a terrible history with anti-Semitism, that people were selling, you know, Nazi-glorifying goods in Europe through the internet. And so suddenly the case for absolute internet freedom didn't seem quite as strong anymore. Faced with a country that legitimately had historical reasons to want to fight anti-Semitism, and I think this case had a strong normative effect on what people thought needed to be some of the limits of freedom. The second thing that this case showed is that when it push came to shove, entities like Yahoo, which had declared themselves unregulable, when threatened with massive fines and potential detainment, suddenly found they had reasons to follow the law. That is to say, Yahoo stood up and said, we're not going to listen to some judgment in some other country just because they say so. But then when threatened with potential detainment, 10,000 euros of fines a day, they suddenly backed down. And this was a shock to people. People had thought the Internet was truly unregulable. They never dreamed that a court in France and a single French judge could bring an Internet giant like Yahoo with a stock valued at nearly $500 to its knees. But that's exactly what happened. And Yahoo coincided partially with the collapse of the bubble. You know, there was this era that everything was going to be different, money, finance, government, and so on. And this is partially when the real world started to catch up. And that was a turning point in the history of the Internet.
So you've been describing how, you know, the French government got Yahoo to take Nazi materials off its Internet auction site. Then we have a case of China asserting its wish to censor, and to censor words like democracy and freedom. So this isn't about hate speech. This is just clear out censorship. And Yahoo was involved in this too. Tell us what the story is.
Well, sure. I mean, Yahoo, the funny thing about Yahoo, Yahoo's a pivotal figure in these early days of the law and the Internet. Because Yahoo, on the one hand, is standing up to France, claiming principles of freedom of speech. On the other hand, it's in China slowly and quietly turning itself into an agent of Chinese state control. They quietly but willingly accept all the duties of self-censorship which the rest of the Chinese media subscribes to. And then bit by bit, they begin to give the Chinese government information it needs, ultimately leading to the arrest of several Chinese dissidents. So there's a little bit of an Apocalypse Now feeling. The once champion of free speech turns into a company, once valued stock at almost $475, dives to $9, becomes, you know, subservient to the Chinese state. And you have, just in that one story of Yahoo, a persuasive picture of what happened to Internet freedom over the last decade.
Now, I should say that Yahoo says it gave up a majority stake in its China service to a Chinese company and that this Chinese company has to follow Chinese law.
That's true. And what's fascinating about that is that Yahoo went to China with these plans to make money and become great. And it ultimately retreated from the Chinese market, having participated. When it handed over the information on dissidents, it did so as Yahoo, not as just an owner in a Chinese company. It eventually ended up retreating from the Chinese marketplace altogether, not because of its controls, but because it lacked the ability to make money in China because it didn't understand the Chinese market well. So again, the differences in culture and geography ended up mattering a lot more than Yahoo thought. Yahoo thought it could just go to China, do the same thing it did in America, maybe listen to some censorship laws and come up making money, but that didn't end up working.
Now, you describe China as having surrounded itself with the world's most sophisticated information barrier. How do they do it? How do they manage to censor websites from around the world?
Well, technically, it's rather easy, and I actually don't think that's the most important part of Chinese control. But I'll tell you how they do set up that barrier. They simply have a list of sites, which changes frequently, but they have a list of sites monitored through the IP address, which are blocked from inside of China. That is, when those sites are requested from overseas, the routers or the computers at the border simply drop those sites and don't pass them on. It's very easy to do. It's actually easier to drop a site than it is to pass it. And every computer, every router, every part of the Internet is designed to be able to drop sites. They're used in corporate security measures and so on. So it's a routine part of the Internet to be able to censor, in fact. It's built in to the technology of the Internet to be able to censor. And the difference between China and a country like the United States or Canada is that China certainly just turns on the filters.
And has China been able to do this with the help of high-tech expertise from American companies?
Well, sure. You know, I spent time in the early 2000s in China marketing some of these goods, and they use standard American equipment. Most of the filtering technology was originally built for corporate intranets, that is, networks inside companies. designed to control employees, China simply turns that around and uses it to control its citizens.
So did you say you were selling these screening technologies to China?
We were marketing them, that's right, yeah, and selling them.
So how did you feel about that? Did you feel like you were helping China censor its citizens?
Well, we weren't really successful enough. I didn't work for Cisco. I worked for a competing company. And Cisco was the top dog at the day, and they were much more successful. Yeah, I had uneasy feelings about it. We had a lot of meetings with the Chinese ministers, and the whole business seemed to me a bit, you know, the level of submissiveness we displayed to the Chinese government I thought was a little bit unseemly, but that was the way people did business.
Now, you describe China as a paradox because on the one hand, it wants to have the most sophisticated internet system in the world and really excel in high tech, but at the same time, it wants to control the information and censor it.
Yes, that's right. It's completely a paradox. If you go to China today, you will find that their information is flourishing as never before. People are chatting, there's bloggers, there's all kinds of stuff going on. But there's a line in there somewhere, and if you cross that line, you get in trouble very, very quickly. Recently, in the last several months, several Chinese quasi-dissidents, really just journalists, have been abducted, kidnapped for doing pretty mundane things. And in our book, we document cases where just posting a kind of a joke about why prostitutes are better than the government can land you with administrative punishments, imprisonments. So it feels very open. It feels completely normal. And that's what's very strange about the control in China. But you cross a certain line, and it's curtains for you.
You say that the Chinese internet is becoming less and less like its counterparts. Is it only through censorship that it's becoming different, or are there other differences between the Chinese internet and what we're familiar with here?
Yeah, there's a lot of cultural differences that end up being built into it. You know, so you can sort of speculate on why that is. But Chinese people, for some reason, love chat rooms. I don't really know why that is, but they're a dominant form of discourse on the Chinese internet. People chatting away. So certain, you know, chat rooms are not that popular in the United States. They've never really taken off. I'll add another country. If you look at Japan, there is a different structure of the way people use the internet. It's mostly based on cell phone usage, people typing away in the Shinkansen, in the bullet train, or on the way to work. And so there are starting to be stronger differences in the way these networks work, and they're actually being built differently to reflect the different cultural interests of different countries.
In your analysis of the directions that the internet has taken in different countries and the attempts of government to control that direction, what cultural differences have you come across in how different countries are shaping the internet?
Okay, so we've been talking thus far about how governments are imposing their controls from above, and that's a large factor in why the internet is becoming bordered. But in fact, the internet started to become bordered not because of government controls from above. Governments were in fact fairly slow to react to the internet. The first impetus for a bordered internet, an internet that differed from place to place, actually came from people below who were using the internet in different places, people who spoke different languages, had different values, and the like. So, for example, in the early years of the internet, or at least in the mid-1990s, the internet was dominated by the English language because most websites and most internet users were English speakers. And many people in the 90s thought that the internet would basically be the vehicle for English to sweep over the world. And in fact, the opposite has happened. People in the world who don't speak English don't want to see an internet in English. They want it in their local languages. And so when you go to different places, you look on internet websites in those different places, and they tend to come up in local languages, reflecting local cultures. The same thing happened with internet advertising. It wasn't very useful to have an advertisement for 1-800-Flowers in New York if you're looking at the internet in France or in China or in India. And so internet users in different places with different tastes and different concerns started demanding an internet that conformed to their local interests. And that, in effect, is how the internet first started becoming bordered. And in fact, it was the technologies developed to enable private demands for local content. It was filtering technologies on the internet, geographical filtering technologies, first grew up in that context to meet private demand, and it was only later that governments came along and used those filtering tools to suit their own ends.
How effective is internet censorship within countries? Do they really censor out all the websites with information that the government considers inappropriate or dangerous for its citizens? Or does a lot of stuff really get through? Is there a lot of freedom and anarchy on the internet in spite of the strictest government's best efforts to clamp down?
Well, sure. It really depends on, in the first instance, how much the government cares about clamping down on information. China is one of the most extreme cases. They're very severe in clamping down on information. But even there, some things get through occasionally and for a short period of time. In the United States, where we value privacy and freedom of speech more, many, many more things get through, even though we try to filter in some respects here as well. But the important point is, for censorship to work, it doesn't have to be perfect. A government doesn't need to cut out the prohibited information 100% to be effective. That's not the way that law works generally. It doesn't try to reduce the incidence of legal violation to zero. It simply tries to keep it at such a rate where the government can achieve the ends it wants. And the Chinese government, for example, they just want to make sure that the government stays in power. That doesn't mean that they can't ever let anything through at any cost. It just means that they can't let information in that's going to lead to a situation where their power will be challenged.
Yeah, I think it's a very mixed situation. I think there's a lot more information out there, but that hasn't necessarily threatened government's control or government's control over their selves. Particularly if you look at countries like Singapore and China, and in particular if you spend time there, there's this weird sensation, as I said, of everything feeling normal. But for some reason, there's something missing, and it's called criticism of government. And you can look for it, but you have to look kind of hard. And if you're just leaving a normal kind of life, you just won't run into it. And in fact, you'll run into much more of what is really propaganda, is people talking about how great the state is, how great the government is. And with there being more total information, there's also a lot more information or a lot more boosting of the state. So the total, there is a greater volume of information, but also the mix the government wants of criticism versus state boosterism. And I think it's that ratio between how much support for the state versus criticism, which is really essential, as opposed to just some forbidden content getting through.
Let's look at attempts by the U.S. government to assert its authority over the internet. For example, the government requested that Google hand over its search database so that the government can see who is going to certain porn sites so it could enforce the Child Online Protection Act. Would you talk a little bit about this case and how it was resolved?
Yes, so search engines are an important target for government control because almost everything goes through a search engine. And for the most part, the United States hasn't exercised that much control over this. But the Google case showed the potential for it. Google, that case itself was a request that Google turn over a huge amount of search records that it keeps, records on what everybody has searched for as long as Google has been around. They asked for about, I believe, a million such records, and they wanted to find out how often people were actually looking for pornography as opposed to other things. But the point of the case, it wasn't that relevant, the actual subject of the case. What was relevant was that it suddenly became obvious to people that government has the power to get from companies like Google, companies like Yahoo, everything that you've ever looked for in your life. And I don't know, for most Americans, I think there's a lot of potentially embarrassing things that they've looked for at one point in their life or another, whether an illness or some strange obsession. And so this case suddenly made it a lot more obvious to Americans that government has the power over the internet that other countries have been more obviously exercising.
Google fought the government's request. Then the judge reduced the request to apply to only 50,000 web addresses.
Right. And so I think what you learn from this case, there's a couple of things. First of all, the interesting thing is that Google is storing all this information in the first place, which I think is a surprise to many people, that everything you've ever searched for on Google is in a database in a computer somewhere. But the other point, more relevant to our book, is that, you know, this shows to people that well, it wasn't a million or 50,000, but it's really the law that's making this decision. Maybe that's not a surprise to lawyers, but I think it's a surprise to people who sort of thought that their search results went off into a little box somewhere, never to come back. They're there if government really wants to look at them. People also speculate that other parts of the government, which do not announce their activities openly, have been also looking at search results, or other parts, parts of the government like the NSA, which aren't required to tell the public or anyone what they're doing, have also been looking at things that people search for.
Since your book is in part a study of how governments have tried successfully and unsuccessfully to assert their authority over the internet, what are some of the ways you think the government needs to be involved or should be involved with the internet?
I'm a big believer in internet freedom, and I'm a big believer of self-governing communities on the internet. But what our history shows over the last decade is how often these flourishing self-governing communities rely on sort of a baseline of government force for really extreme situations. The eBay story is really the best example. eBay set itself up to be a self-governing community that would rely on feedback and rely on the goodwill of its members. And for the most part, that worked. But they found in the late 90s that they had one day to call the FBI and ask the FBI for help because the fraud problems were becoming just too serious. And so, you know, even eBay, which employs more people today than Walmart, in other words, more people make more money off, see themselves as self-employed. A wonderful thing like eBay has a certain requirement of policing from the government for the really bad types, for the people who won't listen to anything, who don't care about their reputation on eBay. And that's where I think that even the best internet freedoms at some level have some reliance on physical coercion provided by government.
But that's a more kind of ad hoc relationship, isn't it? It's not like the government is a partner in eBay or tells eBay how to run its site. It's just that if there is a scam or fraud on eBay, eBay can turn to law enforcement authorities to help it, right?
To the contrary, they work very closely together. eBay hires former law enforcement officials. It has over 800 right now. And they work hand in hand with federal and state officials. So, you know, they don't just call them in for big cases. They work day to day, hand in hand, constantly fighting fraud. It is actually many people are not aware of this, but it is quite a private-public partnership that powers eBay.
This is not a trivial thing, the service that the government's providing. If you didn't have the government willing to help eBay police fraud and prevent it, if you didn't have the government spending its resources to throw people in jail who tried to commit fraud on eBay, or to throw people in jail or at least to enforce contracts for people that make contracts on eBay, if the government wasn't providing these services, eBay literally couldn't exist. It would be a much, much more expensive service. People wouldn't be able to use it nearly as much. And eBay, as we know it, really couldn't happen. So without the hidden hand of government there helping out, eBay and many, many other internet commercial services simply couldn't work.
Have either of you found that your thinking has changed about the relationship of government and the internet?
I think that over the course of writing this book, we both came to discover and appreciate the virtues of government regulation and government control. I think it's fair to say that Tim and I are both, I can't speak for Tim, but I think we're both fairly libertarian. We're suspicious of government regulation, but at least as a starting point. But time and time again in writing this book, we kept stumbling upon the hidden ways that government actually helped out and that government was actually necessary to help make, you know, all of our everyday experiences on the internet work.
You know, I was on the internet in the late 80s. I started early on this, and my early career in networking was as a pirate downloading illegal software. I hope the statute of limitations is over now. But my early days,
I'll
I was
be
a
reporting
pirate.
You as soon as this interview is over.
I was a pirate BBSer, so I sort of have had a long standing. I'm one of these types who had long-standing contempt for government. I think, too, in writing the book, I became sort of reconvinced of what Hobbes said in The Leviathan, that some of the underlying virtues of basic physical security are very difficult to replace. You know, technology can help, and it's a useful tool, but really there's no substitute for trying to convince and get the right policies. And I've become fascinated, and I think one of the underlying themes of the book is I feel we don't fully understand the effects of lawbreaking and its effect on the law. The internet has inspired a lot of lawbreaking. I mean, our claim in the book is not that somehow government's control has been perfect or nothing has changed or, you know, there's nothing, the internet revolution was nothing. There are a lot of laws that have been broken pervasively. Copyright law is a great example. Now, the law often still remains central to the dispute, but the law gets broken a lot. And I've become very interested in these patterns of lawbreaking, crackdown, lawbreaking, crackdown, and how that changes society, how that changes the law itself, and how that ultimately affects the underlying technology. You know, we're not done with that project and understanding that, but that's something that I think sometimes can actually be good. I think it can sometimes be healthy to have a little bit of lawbreaking when the technology changes. And so we aren't, or at least I'm not someone who has become, from writing this book, an absolute statist who believes that, you know, the state must control everything like some kind of French political theorist. Rather, I've become interested in the fascinating ways in which lawbreaking helps us evolve and actually improves the legal system.
Tim, you confessed that earlier in your life you were an internet pirate. So do you think that piracy led to important changes?
Yes, I think it has. You know, by definition, some of the piracy which goes on the internet is criminal, but it's been part of a process whereby we're finally getting to better distribution of music. You know, copyright law throughout its history goes through these waves of piracy. And it was the same with the radio. It was the same with the record player, the original pirate industry. It was the same with cable television. All these industries begin as pirates. And law breaking is almost a necessary part of the industry's evolution to better distribution systems. It's also almost like mutations in the DNA or something. Things have to go wrong before they get better. And so, yes, in some ways, Kazaa, Napster, you know, you can call them pirates, but it's also part of a healthy industrial evolution towards better distribution. And today it may not be perfect, but I notice I can get music on iTunes for 99 cents, and that's a lot better than having to trump my way off the towers and buy these $15 CDs. And so it's not perfect, but it's one way in which the system that otherwise would remain stagnant can evolve.
So you don't think there would have been an iTunes without a Napster?
I don't think so. I know that Steve Jobs copied Kazaa, studied Kazaa, which was the major pirate site of its time, in designing iTunes. I think that Napster begot Kazaa, and Kazaa begot iTunes, and that was, while a little rough along the way, a healthy evolution.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Terry, thank you very much.
Jack Goldsmith and Tim Wu are the authors of Who Controls the Internet?